So, Steve, you wanted to talk about Twitter this week?
I did, yeah.
What could we possibly know about people talking online about subjects they know nothing about?
Well, we do that every week, so let's find out. Welcome to Not Enough Champagne. This week we are going to be diving into social media. One of the few things that I am able to actually claim any expertise in is social media. I work as a digital marketing manager. So the way that politics engages with Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook is something that's something that fascinates me a fair amount. So Corey, what I wanted to kind of start this off with is a quick question for you. How do you think you should use social media to assist in a political cause?
I think there's a few different ways. One of them, maybe, is to try and level the playing field a little bit between different campaigns. So, for instance, the Black Lives Matter campaign has done this in the US. They've been able to help match opponents who are well-funded. You can also use it, I suppose, to try and interact directly with MPs and elected representatives or even journalists. So Tim Farron is on Twitter. You know, you could talk directly to a leader of a political party or to MPs in a way you couldn't do. And you can also use it to organise. So I know I'm part of a political party and our local campaign group will send out emails or send out Facebook invites to door knockings and campaign advice.
Yeah, so you've actually kind of touched on a lot of different ways you can use social media there. What I would say is that the way that a lot of people view social media is quite static. They view it as you can use it for this and you can use it for this and you can use it for this. Whilst in reality, there's actually a number of different ways that political movements, whether it be a political party, a pressure group or whatever, can use social media. There's actually kind of three scales which are the kind of the focus of how most people utilise social media when it comes to politics. And those three scales are organisation versus message distribution. So that's, for instance, the two of your examples there are actually kind of polar opposites. So Black Lives Matter, with the hashtags and things, that's message distribution. It's about getting the message out there. And organisation, you mentioned, with the Facebook invites to go out door knocking. Those are, in a lot of ways, actually kind of polar opposites when it comes to social media and the way people tend to utilise them.
Hmm.
The second you've got is organic versus paid. Now, when I mean organic, I mean things that are naturally occurring, so you're not paying for it. And whilst obviously on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and any other platform, there are paid advertisements that you can have and use. All of the things that you mentioned there were organic. And then what you have is a third thing, which doesn't necessarily impact on people who are organising stuff for it. But if you're doing message distribution, whether it be organic or paid, it's whether the message that you're putting out is propaganda or whether or not it's based upon facts.
Okay.
So of those three kind of scales, what you end up with are a lot of different ways to utilise social media. You can pick and choose any of all of these different categories and be at various points on all of them. They're, whilst I've said it's this versus that, they are scales. You can be slap bang in the middle and doing both. You can lean one way or the other.
And we're probably organic propaganda. I mean, we're still not being paid for this.
Yeah.
And very little of us is based in fact.
Yeah. It's interesting you kind of... All the first thing you did was to go straight to kind of defining what we are, because that's what I've done with the three of the main parties in the UK, the Tories, Labour and the Lib Dems. Now, I've done these because these are the ones that I'm most familiar with. Obviously, the Greens, the UKIP, the SNP all have their own approaches to social media as well, but I'm not as familiar with them, so I've just ignored them for this. So, and it's what's quite interesting is with the Tories, you see a very... an approach which is very different to all of the others. The Conservatives have one of the reasons that they they claimed they won the 2015 election was due to their paid social media strategy. They worked with a number of people to put out Facebook ads in targeted constituencies. So if you were in Dudley South, you were on Facebook, they would hit you up with an advert for why you should vote Conservative or why you should not vote Labour, which is very effective, as demonstrated by the actual general election results. So that's all about paid messaging, which is heavily targeted based on the individuals that you want to talk to. Labour, on the other hand, are much more organic. It's all about kind of just getting the message out there. They certainly in 2015, they weren't paying that much money for adverts. And as such, their social media stuff wasn't as effective, because all they were doing was they were getting retweets, but they were getting retweets from the party faithful.
Mm.
You know, that stereotypical Twitter echo chain that you hear a lot about, and we'll be discussing in a bit more detail later. But what they also did was quite interesting, was they did it for organisation as well. So you had a lot of things coming from Labour for sign up so that you can help us knock on those 2 million doors or whatever it was that they were trying to do in constituencies. Now, it turns out those constituents, the constituencies where doors were being knocked, were the ones they already held rather than the ones they wanted to win. But the notion behind it is actually quite a solid thing. They were using organic social media presence to get people out on the doorsteps and actually engaging with people. And the Lib Dems are the third one I want to look at for this. And in some ways, they're quite interesting. Full disclosure, I used to be a member of the Lib Dems, which I think has been brought up on a few previous things, which is one of the reasons why I'm bringing this up, because it's the one I'm most familiar with. The Lib Dems' social media strategy was all about going viral. At various points, you will find that new stories were being made about little funny things that the Lib Dems had done online. So, for instance, after the last load of local elections, there were no Conservatives left on Watford Council, I think it was, or something like that. As a result of that, they changed their 404 error message, so the message that you get when you try and go to a page on a website that doesn't exist, to say something along the lines of, like, the Conservatives on Watford Council, this page doesn't exist. And they did another thing quite similar after Theresa May took power as Prime Minister, saying, like, Theresa May's mandate for being Prime Minister, this does not exist, this page does not exist. And these things get get press attention because they're quirky, they're interesting, and the Lib Dems have got a history of doing this sort of stuff. There was an interview which Joey Essex did before the general election, where he mispronounced the name of the Liberal Democrats to the Liberal Democats. As a result, somebody quickly altered the logo on the Lib Dem site to have a little cat on there. You know, and it got a little bit of press attention, and it was quirky, and people liked it and enjoyed it.
The internet loved cats.
Yes. Yeah, that sort of thing. So the Lib Dem strategy is really good for kind of getting attention. It's really good for getting it organically, but it doesn't do very much other than that. Now, the notion, I think, behind it is you do these fun, quirky little things, people are more likely to follow you, and then when you do your more serious stuff, they're going to actually see the other stuff.
How's that worked out for them so far?
Oh, well, we went from 56 to 8 MPs, so my guess is not wonderfully, although the social media strategy there, in that aspect, probably not the main cause. I do know that the Lib Dems were doing some paid advertising as well, and I do know that had some success in terms of like the metrics we use to measure how successful these things are, but it didn't necessarily translate into seats. So what you've got there are three very distinct ways of utilising social media from three of the biggest parties in the UK. But out of all of them, the Tories are by far the best of being effective in terms of winning elections with it. So my question for you then is, what do you think that means for the political landscape? Do you think that the fact that they're good at doing Facebook ads matters?
Well, the thing that strikes me is that the Tories, as you say, they're good at doing paid social advertising. Now, the thing about paid adverts is that it requires money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Tories outspent both Labour and the Lib Dems at the last election because they have the big donors to do that. So again, maybe this is just an example of how money talks in politics. Now we're finding it through online medium as well. And online, obviously, that famously, it's where you get stuff done for free. Maybe it turns out actually the best way of doing it is to, if you can pay to get that targeted advertising, whether that is with a leaflet, whether that is with a billboard, or whether that is to target people on Facebook. Also, I suppose it's about the work you can do. It's very easy to draw a cat and do a funny little slogan. You know, we've all seen these memes go around, and it's just, but as you say, I don't think that necessarily changes people's minds. I don't think that necessarily will get people to vote for you. It's not the Lib Dem social media strategy that caused them to lose 40 odd MPs. I mean, tuition fees is part of it.
There were lots of things which caused that.
Making lots of silly jokes does not compensate for doing bad decisions in government, or for making unpopular decisions in government. In terms of Labour's social media strategy, as you say, it turns out that Labour is more interested in talking to itself and talking to its supporters than the wider electorate. Who knew? So maybe the social media strategy is just a
reflection of the wider
mindset. It's a reflection of the wider mindset. The Tories have got the organisation, they've got the money. Labour have got the
will, but the
ability to talk to themselves, and the Lib Dems have funny cats.
I think for me, the major kind of impact that this will have, that this kind of difference has on the political landscape, all boils down to the data which the Conservatives have been able to generate. When I say data, I don't mean kind of they've built an individual profile on every single person that they put out an advert to or anything like that.
They've got interns stalking people on Facebook.
Absolutely, yeah. What I mean is that the Tories know, based on the stuff they did last election, that in Dudley South, these messages did quite well, and these messages didn't, based on the number of people who clicked on the adverts, for instance, as a very basic way of measuring the results. With that in mind, they can take those learnings and put them in the next general election. Let's say it's in 2020, just because that's the next one that's planned. Might be one sooner. Them having that data means that they can, if they adopt another kind of 50-50 strategy like they did last time, 50 seats they want to keep, 50 seats they want to win, what they'll be able to do is just the ones that were they want to keep, just apply the same learnings as last time, and then go, okay, so we know that portraying Ed Miliband as in the pocket of the SNP worked really, really well, and as such, we want to try and do something like that again. So we'll portray, you know, Jeremy Corbyn as in the pocket of Len McCluskey, for instance, or Putin if they wanted to go down the national security angle.
Not going to make the joke about how could they possibly make Jeremy Corbyn look unpopular.
So they take that and they know it works, so they apply it there. So they know they don't have to worry about actually trying to make that work. They know it's going to work in all likelihood. So then can then focus their time and their energy and are able to invest a bit more money in other areas, like the 50 seats they want to win. With Labour, they're not going to have that because they didn't really do anything with it last time round. So everything they do is going to be brand new. So they've got no learnings to actually fall back on from the last election, which means in a general election where social media spend is going to be that much more important because of how effective it can be, they're going to be at a significant disadvantage. And it's not just in the UK where this is kind of happening. One of the biggest concerns that the Republicans have with Trump as their nominee from a kind of a campaigning perspective is that he just doesn't have any kind of notion of the infrastructure that's required to actually get the data that they need. So whilst Hillary Clinton is stood there kind of generating lots of data for them to use, not just in the general election or the presidential election, but in the congressional and Senate elections in the midterms, they're going to have all of this data which they can rely on, and the Republicans aren't going to have any of it because Trump hasn't set up those things. And so you can see both sides of the Atlantic, you've got similar kind of problems happening where one side is embraced digital media as a means to kind of actually reach new people, and the new people there is the relevant bit, whilst the other has just kind of fallen back and ignored it.
As I say, it probably is not much of a surprise that Donald Trump is more interested in advancing his own interests rather than the Republican Party.
And again, that goes down to that one of those kind of scales that I mentioned before. It's organisation versus message distribution. Trump is a classic example of someone who's using it for message distribution. His own personal message, granted, rather than the Republican message. But it's message distribution. It's about getting his views out there. It's a pulpit for him to make his thoughts known. Whilst the DNC and Hillary Clinton are viewing it as an organisational tool.
Going back to the point about Labour and the Tories then, if the problem is Labour are playing catch-up because the Tories have more data, but they also have more money. So they've got more people to analyse that data, they've got more people to put those ads out. But Labour has less money than the Tories. They're going to be outspent last year, they're going to be outspent in the next election as well.
One of the things that's quite interesting about social media advertising is that you are able to kind of target really nichely. And if you're able to target really nichely to the right people at the right time, then it doesn't necessarily matter that you don't have the same budget, as long as you're hitting the right target audience. So if, for instance, Labour only needed to win, I don't know, let's say 12 seats to win an election, they would be able to kind of choose those 12 constituencies, set their adverts for it, and go, okay, we know from the work that we've done that the people who are most likely to vote Labour are middle class, they are 30 to 40 years old, they're both male and female, and generally speaking, they are interested in, let's say, environmentalism and the NHS. So what they can then do is they can use those factors to reach out directly to those people without actually hitting the Conservative voters at the same time. So by doing that niche targeting, they're able to spend less, but actually do more with, potentially get more value out of it. Because not only are you then reinforcing the message to your already existing supporters that you need to get out there and you need to vote because this is a really close election and your vote matters in your constituency, but you're able to reach out to some of the undecideds as well. As long as you've got some form of resourcing to create that advert, and some of the cash to actually get it out there, it's a much more effective and easier way to reach people than relying on billboards or kind of the national media. And I think one of the things that we kind of need to discuss with this is that echo chamber.
Well, there's an interesting paper, and I'll put the link to the paper on the podcast site, and it's a paper that they analysed about 250,000 tweets from 45,000 users during the 2010 midterms. And what they found is that there were two very distinctive right and left wing echo chambers. These kind of echo chambers develop in a couple of ways. One of them is the hashtags that are used. So there's, you know, for the right wing, for instance, it's TCOT, so top conservatives on Twitter. That's a hashtag that kind of segregates out to the right wing. And the other are the blogs that are retweeted. So you're more likely to retweet things that you agree with, and again, you're more likely then to see those things and have that kind of echo chamber there. Although there's some evidence of what they call cross-ideological discourse, it doesn't really happen very often. And so what the conclusion from this study is that the Twitter discussion is really highly partisan, and that discussion often it's more extreme than it would have done in a face-to-face interaction. And they see, the authors of the study, see it as quite a bad thing. Because, and what happens if you just talk in your echo chamber, in your right-wing echo chamber or your left-wing echo chamber, you end up reinforcing your existing biases. You end up being more extreme than you would do. If you're only exposed to your own political viewpoint, then you become more extreme and you reinforce the belief you've got. And that, I think, is quite harmful for democracy, especially in America, where the whole system is built around parties working together. It's bad enough in Britain when you've got a more adversarial system, but you need to certainly compromise and be bipartisan to get stuff through. That's going to be even harder, I think, in this kind of social media echo chamber.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting about the echo chamber is that there's two elements to it, actually. There's kind of like the algorithmic element, which occurs on Facebook, where let's say I was a stereotypical left-winger, and so you put out and shared something from The Canary or a website like that, one of those hard left blogs. You share that, I hit like. Facebook records that, and as such, every time that you post something else from that website or someone else posts something from that website, or you post something at all, I'm more likely to see that come up in my feed than I am my conservative friend who's posting something from conservative home, because I haven't hit like on that. So Facebook is kind of going, I only want to show you things which are relevant to your interests. And it's completely accidental that it has this impact on discourse by reinforcing notions, and ending up just showing me the things I agree with.
So is an unintended consequence of Facebook and social media going to be to kill democracy?
I think it changes it quite drastically, and I'm not quite sure we've worked out how to deal with that. But I think it's not just Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, or anything like that. It's also just down to search engines as well, like Google. Like, if you search for a politician's name, you should find their website. But in a number of instances, depending on how Google views certain websites, it's entirely possible that you could put a different website up there.
What, just ask Rick Santorum,
Much. You can Google bomb something. And as such, that's going to have an impact on how people vote. And no one's quite sure how to react to that. Because Google isn't intentionally doing it, but the way that it does its business, and this is the same for Twitter and the same for Facebook, has an impact on politics and on the democratic process. But no one's actually worked out quite how we can address that, or if it is something that needs to be addressed. And I think one of the other things that becomes quite interesting with the that polarisation and these echo chambers and from these algorithms, though, is that when people online do then start to reach out to people who don't necessarily agree with them, it's the manner in which they do it. Unfortunately, it's not unusual for people to kind of describe Twitter as a cesspit, because when you venture out an opinion, you can almost guarantee that if you've got under followers, you're going to be attacked for it, and that can come in some very dark and disturbing ways, especially for women who are on Twitter as well. Death threats and rape threats are actually quite common, which is massively disturbing.
Mm.
But it is there. And this kind of echo chamber thinking leads you to kind of, at least to this kind of black and white thinking, where you're either with us or you're against us. It couldn't possibly be that you both want to get to the same point, just via different means. You're just good guys and bad guys. And if you're not with us, you're a bad guy.
Twitter reminds me of a little bit of a pub. It's almost like having lots of different conversations going on in a pub. You talk with some of the friends, and some of the friends you'll know personally, like we'll have conversations on Twitter, like we'll go to the pub. And you talk with other like-minded people, like you would do in a pub, and you go and talk to your mates. You might even eavesdrop on, say, Graham Linehan talking to his celebrity mates in the pub, and you can do that, and you can follow celebrities and see what they're doing, mm-hmm. and you can kind of see them from afar. And then occasionally someone might come up to you in a pub and verbally abuse you, and it doesn't happen very often,
but occasionally it does. Yeah,
and it happens. It's going to happen more on Twitter than face to face, because I think online, in that cloak of anonymity, people say things that they would never say face to face.
You know, Twitter could have massive implications for kind of reaching out to and engaging with regular voters for MPs, because it's a nice easy way for you to say, I've got an issue, da 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 da. And then they can just go, okay, here's my email address. Make sure you send it to this one, not the other one on the website, and I'll be able to look at this straight away. Especially female MPs, when they're receiving death threats and rape threats on a regular basis, when any MP is being abused online, whatever form of abuse that might take, they're much less likely to use it as a platform to actually engage with people. I've actually got a lot of respect for a number of the female Labour MPs, like Stella Creasy and Jess Phillips, who actually use it quite effectively as a model and a means to reach out to people, both for their personal interests, but also for their actual campaigning and for their constituency work. They do it very, very well, but they also have to put up with a hell of a lot of shit coming from people. And as such, I find it remarkable that they're actually able to put up with it, because I know I wouldn't. If I were them, I'd just walk away from Twitter and hand it off to the intern.
I think quite a lot of MPs have. Anything that stops voters interacting with MPs is a bad thing.
Yeah.
And especially in the climate of Joe Cox, when I think there's this tendency often to shrug off death threats, rape threats on Twitter. For one of the reasons I've said, that people just think it's guys in their pants in their bedrooms who wouldn't do anything. Actually, that's not always the case, because Joe Cox was receiving death threats on Twitter and she was killed. if you've got a situation where female MPs are being don't feel safe and are being chased out for essentially because they're female and the people who are abusing them, that's terrible. That's horrible.
Yeah, it is a horrific situation to be in. And I think this is one of the things that needs to find a way to be dealt with. Part of this is just down to Twitter actually pulling its finger out and doing something about it. For the first time, they've actually banned someone basically permanently from Twitter because of his activities. This guy named, can never pronounce this properly, Milo Yiannopoulos or something. He's like the editor of Breitbart in America. Breitbart being that quite right-wing or very right-wing kind of website, political news website. And he's just been outright banned. Twitter have just said, no, enough of this shit. You are using your accounts to deliberately organise and direct harassment at people, and they've banned him for it. And that's, from my point of view, a very good thing. He breached their terms and conditions and they've taken appropriate action.
But it's the same with, if we talk about Twitter as being like a pub.
Yeah.
If you kept verbally abusing people at
the
pub,
the bouncer throws you out.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So from my point of view, it's absolutely fine and a good thing for Twitter to do. But that's one person out of potentially millions who are going out of their way to sling abuse at people daily. You know, it's a massive job that will take a hell of a lot of time to find a solution to. I think that's basically it for this edition of Not Enough Champagne. And I think the takeaway that we from all of this is quite simple. It's that too many tweets does indeed make a twat. So that's it from us this week. I'm Steve Haynes. Corey Hazelhurst is my partner in propaganda, and we will see you next week.
See you next week. Goodbye. We possibly know about talking online? Hang on, I've forgotten it already.
About people talking online.